I'd like now to welcome Lucian Niemeyer. His new book of photographs is called Darfur, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe tomorrow, Friday, July 10th, at 6 in the evening. Collected Works Bookstore at their new location on Galisteo Street, right on the corner of Water. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. Collected Works, a new store, is quite something.
It really is. It's fantastic.
I'm proud to be there.
And it's got a huge space for readings like this.
Precisely.
Let's talk about this book, Darfur. Very beautiful and intense and important book. You start the introduction in Western Sudan, in the region of Darfur, or the homeland of the Fur tribe. One of the great travesties in human history is taking place. Brown Arab Muslims are killing black African Muslims in an ethnic cleansing abetted by the government of Sudan. You can trace the roots of this genocide back a few years or hundreds of years or even thousands of years.
Back to 3000 BC. It's an enormous story. In fact, that whole corner of Africa is the front line of humanity. It starts in early pharaoh times when the pharaohs, the Egyptians, went up the Nile and took prisoner Nubians, which they enslaved, and took their herds for food to build their great works. Then later, when the Egyptian Empire waned, the black pharaohs took over, and they were the land of the Kush, or they were Nubians. They too waned around 600 BC, and the Syrians came down and took over the whole coast of Africa from Tanzania to the northern part, and of course that is called the Red Crescent. Where they interacted with the black natives, there you found the humanitarian problems. So it's a long time coming. When the British ran Sudan and Egypt, they determined that in Sudan that there was too big a country to be governed by two places, so they took the capital and put it in Khartoum. Juba, which was the capital of the black and the animist and the Christian, was disenfranchised. So from that time, 1883, you had the problems that occur today, and that is the disenfranchised black run by the brown Muslim. For many, many years, the northern tribes, the black intermarried with the Muslims, brown, and they took their language, Arabic, and they took their religion, Muslim, Islam, and the gap was closed substantially, so that sometimes you cannot tell the color differences when you go to Darfur. In Khartoum, there were many judgments done on the people in Khartoum, in Darfur, especially the black, because of the fact that the Sahara Desert was moving south, there was no water, the brown nomadic tribes pushed down on the fur farmers. When there was a conflict between the fur farmers and the nomads, Khartoum always sided with the nomads. It came to the point where a few military outposts were overrun in that distant land, and Khartoum had a problem. They were engaged in the north-south conflict, which was huge, which 2 million died and many, many, it was huge. And they had all of their military assets being used for that particular problem. So they had this uprising in Darfur, which is a size of France, and has approximately 6 million people. In that area, they had what they call the Janjaweed. The Janjaweed were the brown nomadic tribespeople, but they had also served as mercenaries in the Chad conflict. Subsequently, it became easy for the Khartoum government to hire these Janjaweed to put down the rebellion, and they did so with a fervor. And all of a sudden, that gap, which has closed quite a bit with intermarriage, the color, all of a sudden was open as big as the Grand Canyon. You had brown nomadic people killing black, throwing them in the wells, raping the women, saying, "We want a brown race." that gap was totally split asunder.
And how could that be when there were so many people who were products of both races and both cultures?
What happens is the easiest is when you can see a difference between black and brown. But what happens in this kind of a conflict, when this kind of a genocide takes place, all of a sudden you look for the nuances, and you ask for the nuances. So it goes down and splits the whole community.
So somebody who, for example, a family that genetically had two children, one of whom looks more black and one of whom looks more brown, would be split asunder.
Could be. For sure, there was such a impact of the brown nomads coming down on camels and horses. And then later, when they were thin because of the sheer number of people, then came in the government with their tanks and their jets and their help. And the black fur farmers were no match. They had no army. They had some people that gathered together to form a defensive pact, and they had some rebels that formed a defensive pact, but it's a disastrous situation.
And so here we are in this disastrous situation, and the UN doesn't do anything?
UN is not very capable in these situations. The NGOs of the world came in and really did a job. You have to remember that 6 million people were scattered, and you had two cities, one of which was Nyala and one was Al-Fashir, both under 200,000. And all of a sudden, because of this conflict that happened, they grew to over 2 million, or 1.5 million and 2 million. And what you had was all the people came to these refugee camps where they could find safety and security. Now you have ringed around Nyala 2 million people that are in these refugee camps. They get water, they get food from the NGOs, from the 80% from the United States, in fact. They get medical help, they get schooling, they get many things that they didn't have. But when Al-Bashir was indicted recently for war crimes, and humanitarian crimes in the world court, he told the major NGO organizations to leave Darfur, which shattered the ability of the refugee camps to survive. They had no place to grow anything. They had water there, but they had no place to go to get food or to get anything. So right now you're having a real mass starvation situation and mass migration again.
And so, as you write in the book, if you want to commit genocide, poisoning and starvation are more efficient means than going in with guns and killing people.
Moving people away from their water and their food in Africa is deadly, absolutely deadly. An interesting story. I went into southern Darfur. Very, very difficult. There's nothing there. It's just track land. You can't even get there. You go in through a runway a dirt strip that barely can hold a plane. And it's not easy. A friend of mine takes care of, he found 5,000 people in this wilderness track that were starving. So he took them over. He was an NGO, Persecution Project. He took over the feeding of them. He went in and dug 8 wells. As soon as he dug the wells, all of a sudden it went to 15,000. When I went in, it was after the rainy season, the first plane in. 7 of the wells weren't there anymore. The number of people had gotten down to 8,000. Now, this was 2 years ago. Since then, he has dug 36 more wells. Now, there are 200,000 people that have left Darfur to go to this refugee camp, extremely large refugee camp. When I looked for a map of Darfur, I went to the United Nations, and they had a good map that I needed to use. And I asked them if I could place this refugee camp nomenclature on the map. And they said, we do not know anything about that camp. It had been there for 5 years, 4 years, 5 years. They said, we didn't know. Let us check. They checked for four or five months. There is no such thing. 200,000 people living, and the United Nations has a huge division for displaced people. And this camp is not known.
And you were there.
I saw it.
Yeah, and you took photographs.
Pictures, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So they had a hard time understanding it or knowing it. They still don't know it.
How very odd.
Extremely. I find the United Nations very bureaucratic, very shallow. They are in the periphery. Their jets stay parked. Their cars are beautiful. Their camps are filled. And they have their planes come in to bring fruit and things like that, but they don't leave the camps. That was the case in the Nuba Mountains.
So tell us about your trip. I mean, this is your second Africa book. How did you decide to go back, and what was it like going back for a second time?
I have been lecturing all over the United States on the first book. It seemingly has had a wide audience. In doing the lectures, I was always asked about Darfur. I made the decision that I had to do it. I knew that the difficulty was going through Khartoum, because they had heard of my book, and I said, they're not going to let me in. My cousin, who took me into Rwanda at the time, said, Lucian, I can get you into Darfur. I said, you know, it's very difficult. He says, trust me. So what happened was that I flew into Uganda, met with the ambassador to Uganda from Sudan, and he said he was known to Richard and to an imam there. And so they gave me a visa. But they said it had to be approved, because there is no visas given to reporters to go to Darfur.
And were you considered a journalist?
Sure.
Yeah.
I've done it. Oh, the rest of the story is interesting. So what happened was that I flew into Khartoum, and they had a big dinner for us. At the dinner was a number three person, like Hillary Clinton, State Secretary of State. And he said to me, I have your book, and I don't like it. And I said, and my heart sunk. I said, there was no chance of me to get into Darfur. But they cleared my visa. The visa I have, it's a picture of it in the book. It's unusual. You can't get it. It's a free visa. When I flew in, they had to fly me into Khartoum. The government did. There's no commercial flights. There's nothing like that. The only other way I could have gotten is through an NGO, but then I would have been restricted from saying anything. So they flew me into Nyala, the largest city, and they showed me what they wanted to show me. They showed me they're working on a water plant. They showed me that they're doing different things. But they also took me to a refugee camp. That's when I verified what was going on. It's a very arid country there. The Sahara is moving down, and it's creating real problems for the farmers and for the nomads. They're all starving. And I spent time, and then I got back to Khartoum. From there, I had planned to go in via the south, but I couldn't do that before I went, because they would have known and they wouldn't have let me in. So I went to then I went back to Nairobi, and then back up to Lokochogia, and then took an old Russian 1946 plane in. When I flew in, it was like an MRI. Your teeth chatter, it's so noisy. And a three-hour flight into this very, very, very desolate land. And you're going to hear more about this place called Jacques, because of the fact that there's mass migration going on because of the starvation going on. And they cannot go east. They can't go north in the desert. They can't go west into Chad. So they're going to have to go south. So this camp, which is over 200,000 now, I think will be some kind of large, and will be a major effort for the United Nations and or NGOs in the United States. But most people don't realize that 80% of the food that goes into Darfur is U.S. paid for.
It's among other things, a cautionary tale about the potential effects of climate change.
Very much so. Or abuse of land.
Yeah.
In other words, it's both. The Sahara is moving south, and it is problematic because the earth has been warming. But it was a cause route, but it wasn't the only route. The big route was the coming of the brown Muslim against the black people, and that cultural difference. It could be bridged, but it has to be bridged with love and care, and for a long time it was. But then all of a sudden there was a political decision in Khartoum to use the brown nomads to to put down the rebellion, and all of a sudden you had an enormous ethnic cleansing.
Now, how did you, once you got to the places that you visited, actually form relationships with people? Because your photographs are so striking, and it's clear that you have formed some kind of connection with the people whom you photograph.
Whenever I go into an area like this, I tell them, I'm just a photojournalist. I want to tell your story. In the South, I'm well known. The Africa book, Africa, the Holocaust of Rwanda and Sudan, is a very, very well-known, very well-accepted book as a history book of that area. So when I go into the South, there are no problems. I go alone. There is no problem. I went to New Mountains alone. I went into Darfur alone.
And there's not a language barrier?
Always there are people that interpret, that can interpret. There's always somebody that's been to school or has some English, and I find them there. But I go and there's no guards or anything. There's no contingent of people.
Right.
Rather, it is. So I tell them what I'm doing, and invariably they warm right up to me. These people have been under a lot of travail. They could be very suspicious, and I'm so thankful they've been so open with me.
We're talking to Lucian Niemeyer. His new book of photographs is called Darfur. He will be at Collected Works this Friday, tomorrow, July 10th at 6 o'clock, at Collected Works' new location on Galisteo Street. Do you see any hope? What kind of hope do you see? I mean, some of the pictures have very smiling and hopeful-looking people in them here and there.
When I give lectures now, what I do is I go into the root causes of genocide, whether it's ethnic cleansing, etc. I say that all souls in this world, by all the religions, are created by God. They should have a dignity. They should have a respect. Where one group of people looks down on another a group of people and loses the quality of the soul or the respect for the soul, that's when you have genocide. And I go into that very carefully, because until we start to solve these problems, whether they're cultural, whether they're race, whether they're political, in our country we have that divide going on now politically. We create problems that are absolutely enormous and almost impossible to solve. In the case of Darfur, it will take a regime change. It'll take the president will not let us in because of the fact that he is indicted and he will get tried and he will get killed. So obviously he will maintain his dictatorship as tightly as he can. We have put sanctions, we have done many, many things, but we've not been able to crack the fact of how to get into Darfur. There is the African Union. They have now 10,000 troops there, and they're totally ineffective. They sit in there. Their morale is low. They're not well run. They sit in their camps. When they go out, they get harassed by the rebels. So it's a very difficult solution. And it's, you know, it's easy to cry, save Darfur. But until the world order determines that all genocides are against the law, and they determine that the world will stop them, we're not going to stop them. And the only way to really stop genocides is to respect human beings.
Lucian Niemeyer, thanks so much for being with us. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can also find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz presents an hour of European jazz artists. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.